The scoreboard said I lost today, but what the scoreboard doesn't say is what it is I have found.
Hello and welcome back to Tennis Connected Studios for August 21st, 2016. I'm Nima Naderi alongside Parsa Sammy, and we're here this week to review the Western and Southern Open from Cincinnati, Ohio. This week's podcast is brought to you by Grand Slam Tennis Tours. Join them courtside at the U.S. Open next week for the best tennis experience possible. Before we begin this week's show, let's introduce our co-host Parsa from New York. How are you, my friend?
Doing very well. Forward to the Open for sure.
Absolutely. We have quali starting tomorrow, so that's going to be probably the best qualifying tournament in the world. For anybody in the area, New York area, make sure to get down there. It's free all week. You get a taste of the Open before the Open actually begins, so make sure to check that out. So Parsa, without any further ado, we had the conclusion of Cincinnati today. We had two surprise winners. I don't think anybody would have guessed it. We had Cilic taking out Andy Murray, 4-5. And we had Pliskova taking out Kerber, who was going for the number one ranking in a very easy fashion, 3-1. So, I mean, in a way, you like to see the underdogs come through. I mean, Cilic grabbing his first ever title at this level, even though we all know that he's, a former U.S. Open winner. And we have, Pliskova winning her first premier event as well. So, big day for both of them. And it's great to see some new names into the mix. I don't know necessarily how that will translate into the U.S. Open. If they can carry this form into there and go deep, then that would be, I think, nice to see for everybody, because then you're building some more star power. But if they flame out early, then you just know that since it was a little bit of a tired tournament, for all the top-ranked players, and that's why we had basically the results that we had. So, moving into, let's start with the women's draw. So we had Pliskova, as I mentioned, taking out Kerber 3-1. Kerber going for the number one ranking. Serena pulling out before the event started with a shoulder injury. She took the wild card, which she was initially not into, since she took the wild card, came down with her team, practiced, said, listen, I'm going to have to bail. Shoulder's not 100%. So for me, that's a pretty bold statement, because it's one thing for her to say, listen, I lost early in Rio, that's a bummer, but now I'm here in Cincinnati, I came all this way over here, and I'm still not going to play. So, Parsa, how much of that is, I have some different theories, and I want to bounce them off of you, and you tell me what you think. So, I'm Serena Williams, and I come down, want to play, I want to make sure that I retain the number one ranking, which, inevitably she did, because Kerber didn't win today, but that wasn't in her hands, it was in Kerber's. She comes in, she doesn't play. So is she thinking at that point, like, I'm feeling pretty good, but I'm just going to now save myself. I know I can do some damage at the U.S. Open, and I'm going to bail and get down to New York, get settled in, and go from there. Or was it, in your opinion, a legitimate injury, and she's like, listen, I need to be as fresh as possible for New York. So for that reason, I'm going to, ripcord this one and not play, and then get ready for the U.S. Open. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely she wasn't 100% and probably wanted to see how it would go, and probably got to practice a couple times and it felt a little bit worse. And she probably figured that if I play more, then it's going to only get worse and I'm not going to be able to recover in time for the Open. So the wiser move would be to take the extra time and let it heal completely before trashing. And I think that would be the logical step here and the logical move. Otherwise, there was every motivation to play and retain her number one ranking, which she ended up doing anyway. But I think that's why she took the wild card initially, because she wanted that option. And I guess she made the best decision for her.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm looking at, for instance, the stats on today's match, and it was pretty much whitewashed from the beginning. Pliskova won 86% of her first serve points. smacked in 7 aces, broke curb or serve on 5 occasions. But with all of that said, you know, I really like what I'm seeing from Kerber. Nothing has really changed. I mean, she's there now every week. She's put, you know, Wimbledon finals, Cincy finals, Rio finals. I mean, she's, you know, she's right there. And she's, I think, for sure solidified herself as the number two ranked player in the world. And, you know, she's within touching distance of Serena. And there's a lot of different scenarios that if they come into play, you know, then Kerber could be number one at the conclusion of the U.S. Open. And we have to think at some point, you know, as great of an athlete and as great of a player as Serena Williams is, this has to come to an end at some point. I mean, she can't be number one forever. So does that happen and continue to win majors? I still think she's, you know, the greatest athlete that, you know, we've seen in probably the last 20 years on the women's side, at least maybe ever. And that's why she's continuing, you know, her longevity and, you know, into her 35th year, and she's still, you know, she's still winning tournaments. So it's remarkable. But the U.S. Open is obviously a different animal. I think she's going to have less pressure on her this year because she's not going for that Serena Slam. Lost in the semis last year to Vinci. So she's going to have some points definitely to gain. I don't know if she's really looking at it at like that at this stage in her career. It's just about winning that title and hoisting the championship. So watch out for Serena. I definitely think, though, if you look at it, you know, going in right now, we definitely have to place, you know, Kerber and Serena as the top two favorites. I mean, then followed by, you know, just how the rankings are pretty much set out right now with Radwanska and Muguruza following closely behind them. So that's my take on that. I don't know if you have any closing words on the women's side, any other developing stories that you saw throughout the week.
Yeah, I mean, nothing much. The only developing story, really, is that what a tough week, men's and women's.
Yes, yes.
After Rio, with the complicated schedule and the travel and all the withdrawals and just the chaos that's going on, my one wish is I hope that all the players find their balance and prepare themselves to do the best they can at the Open. That's the only thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're right on that one. It's, you know, exactly what I was going to say. You look at the schedule this summer, and it's just been brutal for those especially who played Canada, played Rio, and played Cincy, which were quite a few players. And it's just like, you know, that's a grind. You know, you're going back and forth. You're going into different countries, and that's three different countries, right, in the matter of a few weeks. So, and now you got 1 week off. Basically, everybody's going to be down in New York starting tomorrow or Tuesday, right? And then your matches are going to start Monday or Tuesday next week. There's not a lot of adjustment period. And I think more than anything, this is the summer of opportunity for lower ranked players where you can really build your ranking and, you know, sneak in, win a couple rounds at the U.S. Open, get yourself into the top 100, make some, obviously, some good cash, which will help sustain the player and just take it from there. Next year's a different story. I think you're going to see a lot of players, hopefully at full strength, with a lot, you know, more break time after Wimbledon. You're going to see, you know, the regular break that you see from all the top players, and then, you know, getting back into Canada and then Cincy. So it's going to be a much different story leading into the U.S. Open. This summer was just so chaotic for everybody involved that it's, you know, that's why you're having a lot of these surprise results. Shifting gears now to the men's side, we had Marin Cilic, where, you know, you look at him, Parsa, as a Grand Slam winner, and he kind of went the Rawinko route where he won a Grand Slam before he won a Masters Series, which is, you know, a little bit atypical. But, you know, you have Cilic winning, you know, 4 and 5 today against Andy Murray, who was on a 22-match winning streak, hadn't lost a match since the finals of the French Open to Nole. And then he cleaned up, and I saw him play against Burdick, which was such an interesting match because he was with, you know, Coach Ivanidzevic before that, starting in Cincy. Burdick picked him up, and, you know, they want to try to do something now. Burdick is obviously hopeful that he can bring the same Goran can bring him the same results that he brought for Cilic. But, you know, unfortunately, Burdick will be out of the U.S. Open now with appendicitis, so we wish him well, definitely, for a speedy recovery. But in that match, you really saw, for me anyways, Parsa, I saw that fire back in Cilic's eyes, kind of like in the 2014 U.S. Open where he was just, you know, lights out, you know, super high first serve percentage. He won 100% of his first serve points in the second set today, Parsa, against Andy Murray, 16 of 16. So that's, I don't care how tired Murray was, that's still a heck of an effort. And that rhythm, you know, even as if it really fixed that motion by dropping the toss and making it a more rhythmic motion without as much of a pause. And when he's in that type of frame of mind, and you know, then he's feeling better on the forehand and he doesn't get the yips. He was starting to get that a little bit towards the end of the sets against Murray today, but his backhand is rock solid and he's such a good mover for his height that he's going to be tough to stop. And you know, let's not forget, this guy won the US Open in 2014 and he made the semifinals last year. So it's not like he had a bad, you know, follow-up to his championship run. Even though he got annihilated by Nole in the semis, he's still in the semis. So this guy knows how to play in that tournament, and he's coming off of this title. So you got to watch out for Cilic, in my opinion. And he's going to be under the radar, even though he won Cincinnati. He's not going to be, you know, like the Djokovic's and even the Nadal's and Murray's with all of this fame that they have behind them. So watch out for him. And other than that, I mean, Murray is going to be right up there. He's probably feeling confident. I know you're going to have some things to say about potentially his fatigue, because he's played a lot of tennis. And then, you know, sum up this match for me, as well as, you know, some of the highlights you saw from this tournament. And then we can talk about some developing stories going into New York.
I mean, most importantly, you know, as much as I don't want to see Cilic be the one that's in form, I mean, he's deservedly won the title. As you said, his statistics are off the chart, and he's back to clubbing the ball and playing free. And as his serve goes, is how he goes. And he plays his best tennis, as he's proven the last 2-3 years on the hard courts. And, you know, it looks like this guy's lining up to make another deep run, and there's no reason for you to think otherwise. I mean, he can hit the cover off the ball. He can be consistent, and he can do it for long periods of time. And like you said, he can cover for a big guy. He can cover the court extremely well. And I mean, that's the number one thing. My secondary story on the men's side would be that you know, Andy Murray's interview that he said that he's going after the number one. I mean, he proved that, right? Having a cold, coming off of the Rio final, which was a long epic match, and getting to Cincinnati and getting to the final, I mean, what an effort that is. And you can tell that that he's really, truly going after number one, which is the only thing that's left on his resume to accomplish besides the French Open. And so, you know, it's – and I guess Australia too, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's got a couple more things to do, but he's looking to clean up his resume and make it – one of the best in history, because that's the standard of his era, is you have to be the best in history in order to stand out in this era. And so anything less than that is subpar, is secondary. And so it's nice to see Murray in this mindset and on this mission, and I think a lot of praise needs to go to him, and hopefully he doesn't you know, pay the price at the US Open. I hope he can have a good run and then take the time off that he needs and recover for the fall season. But we'll see how it all unfolds. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, and then, you know, you saw, obviously, Nadal, who looked like a shell of himself against Chorich. He lost, you know, what was it, 1-3 or whatever. And he was just, you know, spent. And you can't really take too much stock into that result for sure. I know Nadal can put up a better fight against Chorich without question. But you have to ask yourself how fit he's going to be now, with a week to go going into New York. I think he's going to play, and he's gonna be there. I think, I would say maybe probably third, fourth round would be a good result for Nadal at this point, depending on his draw, of course. If it really opens up, then maybe he can make into the quarters. But if he gets, you know, a couple rough guys in the first rounds and, you know, they're long matches, I don't know if he has that confidence yet that he can go deep. But again, this is Rafa Nadal that we're talking about. He played a ton of tennis in Rio, which I think will give him some confidence, just because of, you know, just back to back playing, you know, 4 hours a day basically for a week. So that's you know, that's going to bode well for him. You have any thoughts on Nadal going into the U.S. Open?
I mean, not a ton. You know, it's 100% Nadal is 33% of what he used to be. So is that clear, Nima?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, and
you know, I can't. I don't like seeing it. He's a great competitor, a great fighter, but he is on his last legs, and we've sort of been predicting this every year for the last 3 or 4 years, but now it's actually true. And before it was just sort of hearsay, but this is the end. Nadal does not look like a guy who's going to be a contender, who's going to be able to pull a miracle off, even, Nima, because he doesn't have that kind of game. He has to be able to defend, and he's clearly lost a step. And unless he decides to gas up that serve and get real aggressive, the end is very, very near.
Yes, and that's, you know, we've been saying that for a while, and, you know, a lot of people obviously know that we've been heavily into coaching now for so many years that's what we really believe. I mean, this is not a game. You know, you look at Murray and Djokovic right now, and even today, it was amazing to see Murray. It was a tactical mistake in my eyes, because, you know, he's playing against a guy like Cilic, who was... Another thing we got to give Cilic credit for is that he played until 1:35 in the morning last night against Dimitrov. And then he comes in and he still beats Murray today. So he didn't have a lot of sleep. That's a very quick turnover, right? But needless to say, he's obviously going to be the aggressor. He's going to come out and start, you know, hitting a lot of cross-court shots off the rise, hammering them with his power. But Murray was still like, okay, I'm going to defend. I'm going to drop back 6-7 feet behind the baseline, you know, even chip some forehands, wait until you miss because I believe in my legs, even as tired as I am, which I thought was a tactical mistake because I thought he would try to shorten the points a little bit considering how much tennis he's played. Nadal cannot do that anymore. Even if he's 100% fresh, because he's lost a little bit, his forehand is not as ferocious as it used to be. And that's, as I've said throughout this entire year, that's the biggest thing that I've seen, along with his movement, is that his forehand is not even close. It's like 50% of what it used to be. Backhand is still pretty good. Serve, I don't think is worse, but it's not like it was when he won the US Open in 2010. Obviously, his returns are not bad, and his volleys are okay, but... It's sad because he's such an exciting guy and people love him so much, you know, deservedly so, that if he's going deep in tournaments, it just adds to the magnitude and the atmosphere of the event, just like a Federer can do. But he's obviously not there, and, you know, hopefully, you know, Rafa can do something, at least do better than he did last year when he lost, I believe, third round to Fognini in 5 sets. So if he can, you know, do better than that, that would be great to see.
And it's safe to say, Nima, right? An end of an era?
It's, wow, we got to get ready because, you know, these guys, as great as Murray and Djokovic are, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. They don't have the same star power. And this is not like you're talking about two tomato can players. One of them has 12 Grand Slams. The other guy has 3. And they've both been there for over 10 years doing this. So it's not like they haven't had the opportunity to gain that type of fan base and that much excitement around their matches. They play a very similar game. And Djokovic plays a little bit of a better version of what Murray plays. So that diversity that you had with an Agassi-Sampras, that you had with Nadal and Federer, is not there. So it's really hard to, you know, gain that type of excitement going in, let's be honest. And from a personality standpoint, I don't think they're as charismatic either. This has nothing to take away from their actual games, because they're both, you know, Hall of Famers, incredible players. But we're just talking about, you know, exposure to the sport, kind of the stuff that, you know, a guy like Nick Kyrgios could bring. We saw what he did earlier in the event. He was just cracking 3 rackets on the changeover, going nuts. And, you know, he bowed out after he had a good run in Atlanta. And I really think that if Kyrgios, Parsa, just to finish off, if he had taken out Chorich, I think he definitely would have made the semifinals here. He would have beaten Nadal, and then he would have beat Cilic, I think, too, and he would have went forward from there. That's just my opinion. But, I mean... You know, that's a could have, should have. So that's not really important. Now, I want to also talk about 2 other players. Talk about Dimitrov quickly. You know, he's been putting together some decent results. Lost early in Rio, quarters in Canada, and then semifinals here. So is he ready now with obviously some, you know, some weaker fields in Masters, no doubt. But nevertheless, he is winning some matches. Is he ready now to make a decent run at the U.S. Open in your eyes?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. He won't go to the semis, but I think I could see a round of 16 or quarters for sure.
Okay.
He's playing solid enough and building his confidence enough, you know, but he's looking as if he's not improving his weaknesses. And that's ultimately what it comes down to. It's a little bit here and there, in the later stages of a slam like that. And, I think he's regaining his form. I just don't think he's improving at the same time. I think it's more about regaining and less about actually getting better.
Yeah, and again, another guy who, you know, gravitates towards a lot of people. He's got that fan base. Monfils is kind of like that. Tsonga has that as well, too. Guy that, for me, can work on that a little bit, and I know McEnroe, he's, you know, guy who's either places pretty close to yours in Long Island, has been coaching him now. And Raonic was there for a couple of weeks working with him. But what a disappointing result for Raonic. I know he made the semis, and we got to, you know, grade him now at the highest level, Parsa, of you know, saying, well, this guy's, you know, wants to be number one in the world. But losing 3-3 to a pretty fatigued Andy Murray after being pretty fresh coming in with no injuries, I mean, to me, that's a terrible result. And for somebody who didn't go to the Olympics ultimately because he wants to win the U.S. Open, how do his chances look for you? Tough one.
Wimbledon was his chance. It was his chance to prove that he was going to be different. And I've said this all along. McEnroe's not the guy that's going to bring that difference. For him to go on the attack and to be even more of an attack guy isn't his issue. I think he's doing that at the correct percentage in order to win a slam. But I think the number one issue comes down to when he has to play on somebody else's terms, which is 30, 35, 40% of the points that he's going to play in a match.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where the struggle is coming. And, it's funny. It's like looking back, you know, when he worked with Gallo Blanco, you can see why Gallo Blanco was keeping him on clay and in Europe for a long time, because he was completely working on his weaknesses, and it really helped him bring him to this stage. And looking in hindsight, I was wrong about that pairing, in that I felt like, and we both felt like, that he needed to be more aggressive and offensive in order to have that strength. At the same time, right now, I think his offensive game has actually gotten so much better.
Mm-hmm.
He's able to attack. He's able to move north and south. But then what happens to the guy that can give him variety, give him different heights, give him different spins, make him move left and right? He's a lame duck. He's done. And so once he reaches an opponent who has that skill set, who can do that, he's going to lose every single time. And that's what Murray does. Murray's sort of laughing at him. I'm dead tired, but. You can't handle my junk. I mean, you can't get through my defense. And so now what?
Yeah, so. Exactly. And I think at that stage, then you see Raonic pull the trigger too early and come in on pretty weak approach shots. You know, something like a guy like McEnroe, because he's so gifted that he could maybe pull that off, especially in the older days where they're not, you know, smacking the ball as hard, obviously. But nevertheless, he had that court sense that he could... And the athleticism and the wherewithal that he knew that, okay, look, I'm hitting this, I'm going to be in, and I'm going to still make this volley. I don't care. A guy like Patrick Rafter, so athletic at the net, right? Pull it off. For me, Milos, I even saw him, you know, coming in. He's still working on that volley stuff, but, you know, he's not bending his knees, and he's hitting like, you're not McEnroe, man. McEnroe didn't need to bend his knees. He's still making volleys, right? And it's going to be an interesting, but listen, at the end of the day, you know, Milos likes McEnroe. And he thinks that he's good for him. And I think as long as he believes that and he's making respectable, you know, performances at Grand Slams, he's going to hold on to him. So he just, I think that's just the way that it's going to be. He holds the cards, he holds the money, and, you know, McEnroe will say, okay, no problem, man. I'm there with you. You're going to pay that, you know, the paycheck. I'm going to show up. So going to be interesting. And then lastly, Parsa, before we wrap it up for this week, you know, thoughts on Novak Djokovic now before we come back next week and preview the U.S. Open. You know, haven't really seen much from Djokovic. You know, he's popped up a little bit here and there on social media, but not a lot. Lost early in Rio. Didn't play Cincy. So he's sticking with his game plan, his scheduling that he had, you know, going in to the summer. Is he undercooked in terms of matches, in your opinion? Or is he so superior in his overall, you know, like his legacy right now, that he doesn't really need a lot coming in as the number one seed?
I think the matches are critical, actually, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I think it's an error for him to, you know, to not do that. But at the same time, I think he's the invincible one and the one that will find ways, even though when he's not playing his best, to make himself get matches. And what I'm getting at is that I think he'll find his way into the second week, and if he does, then it's enough matches to get him through. Will he be playing the best tennis of his life, and will he be in form in order to win a slam against a variety of players? I don't know. You know, I think it comes down to mentality and mental toughness, and, you know, sort of you know, just looking at his overall being. I mean, you have to kind of scratch your head and be like, you know, what's going on with the guy? I think it's a valid reason or a valid point to sort of question what's going on with Djokovic right now. Is he injured? Is he, you know, having coaching problems? God knows what's going on behind the scenes, but he doesn't seem himself. And I think there's some underlying circumstances that are, you know, overriding the mental toughness that it takes to play his style of tennis. I think there's something extra there, and I think if he had the matches and had the confidence, that it wouldn't make a difference. But you know, I think he needs to be playing tennis, and we'll see. It's going to come down to, hopefully he doesn't have Del Potro in the third round, because he's going to lose again.
Yeah, and there you go. And that, now you just talked about the guy who could probably not win it, but he's definitely good for an upset. I mean, can you imagine right now Delpo facing Nadal in the first round? Or like against Djokovic or Murray? Because it could happen. He's coming in unseeded, right? As a wild card, which is very rightfully so that the USTA finally gave him. That's going to be fun, man. I'm really looking forward to being there and seeing him in his first match, because people just love that guy, and he knows how to play the crowd, and such a charismatic guy, and he's got that forehand that's just, you know, out of this world, next level forehand, and it's going to be really cool to see live once again. I think the last time he played the US Open was 3-4 years ago, so it's like he hasn't been there for a while too, so it's going to be nice to see him back in the Big Apple. Happy to say that I'm going to be there as well too, so Parson and I will reunite for our next podcast live in person, which is great. And in the meantime, make sure, what's a couple of tournaments this week, Parson? I believe in Connecticut, New Haven, and as well as Winston-Salem for the men's. So watch out for those this week. US Open qualies is starting tomorrow, men's and women's. Main draw starts next Monday. Parson and I will be back later this week to preview the US Open, both men's and women's draws. Make sure to catch us throughout the week leading up at ParsaSammy on Twitter. For myself, at Tennis Connected. You can also download this podcast on iTunes. And lastly, for anybody still looking for some last-minute packages or tickets to the US Open, make sure to hit up Grand Slam Tennis Tours for all your ticket and travel needs. Finally, Parsa, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Look forward to next week.
Absolutely. And thanks, everybody out there, once again for listening. And we will chat with you guys later this week. Be good, and let's get ready for the US Open.